Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States is returning to economic policies last seen in the early part of the 20th century, policies that led to the Great Depression. Of course, I'm talking about tariffs. And this week, Donald Trump implemented new tariffs on imports from every country in the world, including some that produce nothing because they aren't inhabited, at least not by humans. Our closest trading partners have been slapped with tariffs, as have some nations that we've tended to keep at arm's length. Tariffs on steel and aluminum have increased to 50%, and there are plans for additional tariffs on goods like wine and champagne from the European Union. China has responded to our tariffs by ratcheting up their own up to 84%. And of course, we have 104% tariff on their goods. And if this persists, an iPhone could set you back, $2,500, $3,000 or so. Of course, this is setting off alarm bells at businesses of all sizes as they scramble to deal with this new reality and as they anticipate consumers refusing to pay higher prices in an already inflationary economy. And investors in markets around the world have been running for the exits as stock markets have experienced deep plunges in value. Trillions of dollars have simply evaporated. And some analysts say we have taken a robust U.S. economy and pushed it into recession. Our state is particularly vulnerable to certain tariffs, and we're going to examine that in this new paradigm this hour. Mark Bittner is back with us. He is chief economist at Piedmont Crescent Capital. Daniel Kurtzleben is White House correspondent at NPR. And Jeff Dorfman, is professor of agriculture and resource economics at North Carolina State University. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Daniel, let me begin with you. Donald Trump announced sweeping tariffs last week, and still people are wondering what the end game is. When he first spoke of imposing tariffs on China and Mexico and Canada, he said it was to punish them for not doing more to stop the flow of fentanyl into our country. He later gave other reasons. Do we have this morning, as China has reciprocated last night, do we have any better understanding of what his goals are than we did last week? Is there more than this just Donald Trump scratching an itch that he has long had?
The answer is, I mean, more than last week, no, I would say we don't. But I mean, to lay out what he has said the goals are, he has said that the goals of tariffs, at varying times he said that the goals are to raise revenue for the government, to use the tariffs as bargaining chips, like you suggested, to get Mexico and Canada, especially Mexico, to crack down on, for example, illegal immigration, on the flow of fentanyl into the U.S., to get China to change some of it, what he sees as unfair economic practices, and also to boost U.S. manufacturing. Now, Trump has said all of those things for quite some time. He said all three of them on the campaign trail all the time last year. But those three, by the way, are contradictory, because if you're using a tariff as a bargaining chip and it works, then you theoretically, one would imagine, wouldn't impose the tariff, then there wouldn't be any revenue from it. And if you're getting revenue from the tariff and Americans are paying the tariff, then you're not going to boost manufacturing. So all three of those things do not work together. That said, the one thing I would add here is that in recent weeks, Donald Trump and White House officials, when you ask them, will say that manufacturing is the primary goal at this point. The idea is to disincentivize Americans from buying those foreign goods by making those goods more expensive, and therefore to get Americans to buy more American goods and to get more companies to move factories to the U.S.
He's been talking about tariffs for 10 years now. He mumbled about them in the first administration, and he's talked about them on the campaign trail constantly through the last presidential campaign, and everybody was quiet about it. Now, suddenly, people who are experts at this one would presume, people who are in high finance have suddenly come out of the woodwork and said this is not a good thing. Billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, who is a Trump supporter, posted on X on Monday, quote, "The global economy is being taken down because of bad math. The president's advisors need to acknowledge their error before April 9th and make a course correction." Diplomat, a political consultant, one-time national security advisor in the first Trump administration, John Bolton, says these moves constitute financial illiteracy. And J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon warns that these tariffs threaten to raise prices, drive the global economy into a downturn, and weaken America's standing in the world. It appears, Danielle, that we have given one man the power to control, to strangle, to tank the world's economy, making him the most powerful person in the history of the globe. Why?
Well, if you look at the way that trade policy has always been done prior to this, it has generally been Congress's purview. I was talking to a deputy U.S. trade representative this past week who worked in the George W. Bush administration, and he was particularly stunned by all of this because, as he put it, back in his day, when trade policy was happening, he couldn't talk to Congress enough. No matter how much he told members of Congress about a particular trade deal, they wanted to know more. They wanted him on Capitol Hill more. What's really stunning about what's going on right now is that Congress members seem to have ceded trade power to the president. He does have some statutory power to do some of these deals that Congress has given him, but they seem to just be very hands off. It's really fascinating watching, especially senators yesterday. There was a hearing with the U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer, and you've started to see some cracks among Republicans. Democrats are very angry about all of this, but Republicans, especially from agricultural states, Iowa, Chuck Grassley, Tom Tillis, North Carolina, really starting to say to Jamison Greer, in ginger ways at least, hey, what's the end game here? We're very worried. So you're seeing some cracks on Capitol Hill, but yeah, it is really, really strange to suddenly have the president doing all of this tariffing, not Congress playing a part.
Jeffrey Dorfman is with us. He's a professor of agriculture and resource economics at NC State University. And you have said, doctor, that the only way that this move toward tariffs could be good in the long term is if it is a negotiating tool and it gets us to freer, fairer trade with other countries. Do you think that is the plan behind all of this?
I wish it were the plan behind all this. It looks less and less like it is the plan every day. President Trump gets asked about whether it's just a negotiating tool. And admittedly, if it was a negotiating tool, you can't say it's just a negotiating tool. But he's now sort of openly saying, no, I want to collect the tax revenue for a while. I want to bring the manufacturing home. I want to get rid of, he thinks we should run a trade surplus with every other country in the world. So he's currently saying that it's not a negotiating tool. And as Danielle pointed out, and as you pointed out, he's been telling us what he's going to do on trade for a long time. And we've kind of tried hard to believe that he only meant some of it. But we're going to have to face the fact that maybe he really meant everything he was saying. And I agree, Danielle's right that it's all contradictory. But we're starting to come to the conclusion that maybe the thing he cares about the most is trying to reduce our imports from other countries.
You talk about this being a good thing if it leads to freer, fairer trade. How would you describe what we've been experiencing over the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years with the tariffs that we have in place and with the way trade has been conducted over that time period, at least since the end of World War II? How would you describe it?
Sure. We have had a regime of very low tariffs for the last couple of decades, but there are still many non-tariff barriers that other countries have against American exports. So it's very hard to send our food exports to certain countries because of sanitary or health regulations they put up. A lot of countries won't buy genetically modified commodities, so we can't sell some of our things. It's hard to sell American cars in some countries. So there certainly have been some trade barriers that don't show up in tariffs. And countries could do, and apparently are now offering to do better. So I think we're almost reaching the point where we need to divide the world into two groups, China and everybody else. I think there is an off-ramp here where President Trump makes deals with kind of everybody else in exchange for some concessions so he can declare victory. And then we're just left with these sky-high tariffs on China and China retaliating with sky-high tariffs on us.
Mark, the New York Times reported yesterday that, quote, Wall Street billionaires are not used to being on the outside looking in, but that is where they find themselves after Trump ignored their appeals to call off his tariff plans, which they fear could endanger the economy. That's from the Times. Although they haven't been making a show of it out front until recently, evidently behind the scenes, they have been trying to change Donald Trump's mind. They keep coming up empty. Is that unusual? Is it unusual for Wall Street titans to be warning against policies about to be undertaken by the White House or by the Congress? And if not, is it unusual for them to be ignored?
Well, not with it would be unusual with any other president other than President Trump. I mean, Trump generally ignores everybody. I mean, the louder people scream, the more he's likely to stand steadfast and say, yeah, see, it's working. And when you think about this whole trade mess that we're dealing with here, the fighting back from Wall Street is actually working in his favor, because he's after helping the forgotten man, the folks that have been hurt by free trade in Ohio and in North Carolina. That's who he is out there trying to help.
Is he? That's what he says. Well, but is that what's going to happen?
I don't think so. But I mean, you look back at J.D. Vance's history and Hillbilly Elegy and his selection as vice president and the importance that Trump had winning the swing states was for Donald Trump. That's the focus, and he knows it's going to be painful. That's probably why he's doing it earlier. If it was me, and this is the hardest thing to do, is that when you think about Donald Trump, it's sort of like thinking about the Fed. When you think about the Fed, it's not important to think about what you think the Fed should do. It's more important to think what you think the Fed will do. So when you think about Donald Trump, don't pretend that you're thinking for Donald Trump, thinking what Donald Trump is likely to do. And this was going to be messy. This is not the way I would do it. It would be far better to address the problems, I would say the negative externalities of free trade, which are when people are displaced, like when we had Pillowtex shut down, the largest layoff in North Carolina's history, roughly 5 years after China was admitted to the WTO. It took for workers that had a high school diploma and knew what they wanted to do, it took a minimum of 3 years for them to become gainfully employed. And they'll never make up for the losses that they incurred during that time period. And the same thing's true in Ohio, the same thing's true in Michigan. And Trump has somehow, he has gotten into that constituency. And that's what he's trying to do right now. I mean, he is trying to do all the other things, raise revenue and try to reshore as well.
And it would seem that it would take longer to bring manufacturing back in most cases, which we can talk about later on in the program. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about tariffs that are being imposed that went into effect last night at midnight. And, of course, China imposed an 84% tariff on products coming from the United States to their country. We've imposed 104%. That's just the surface, scratching the surface. Mark Vittner's with us. He is the chief economist with Piedmont Crescent Capital. Danielle Kurtzleben is White House correspondent for NPR. And Jeff Dorfman is professor of agriculture and resource economy at NC State University. Mark, analysts who are watching markets slide around the world keep referencing Smoot-Hawley, which was, of course, the tariff that was imposed in 1930 on over 20,000 imported goods to protect farmers and businesses in this country during the Great Depression. But it led to a collapse of global trade and helped to worsen the depression. Are there echoes in what's happening now from that?
Well, there's certainly concerns about it because the effective tariff rate is the highest that it's been since the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And just the trade battle that we had with China in the last decade caused about a 20% drop in trade with China. So if you we're putting tariffs on virtually the whole world right now, a 20% drop in trade would be pretty devastating to the global economy. I mean, that is what folks are fearing. I still hope that that we're going to see folks come to their senses. I mean, it's going to take, it's not just a case of Trump coming to his senses. We're going to have to see both sides come to their senses. Just looking at Trump's past, if you try to out-Trump Trump, things tend to get worse and they spiral out of control. And that seems to be what China's trying to do right now.
Trump's been saying, Dr. Dorfman, that we've been ripped off for decades by countries around the world because of our policies, stupid policies put in place by stupid people. I'm using his words here. But we've been living through, if you believe all of the reports, even though you may not be personally experiencing it, we have been living through the best economy in the history of the world. So why do we need to live through this pain to adjust these deficits, these trade deficits?
That's a good question, and it's unclear there's really an answer. It is certainly true that manufacturing jobs appeal to a certain segment of the American workforce that maybe doesn't have the either skills or the desire to do office work, knowledge work, or service industry jobs, and that those jobs are in shorter supply because of trade with other countries than they might be otherwise. But the interesting thing is that the United States is still the number two manufacturer in the world, and our manufacturing output has been going up this entire time. We're simply able to do that with fewer workers than we used to. And so even if we bring manufacturing back or increase manufacturing output in the US, it is very unclear that's going to employ many more workers. Even worse, for example, you know, we're here in North Carolina today. The average wage for a manufacturing worker in North Carolina is below the average wage for all jobs in North Carolina. So why would we want necessarily to increase an industry that pays below average wages is a question that somebody might want to ask.
As long as we're talking about North Carolina, let's talk about how this might impact those of us living here, those of us who have businesses here, those of us who are farmers in the state, because I read yesterday that North Carolina is said to be the second most potentially vulnerable state in the nation to these tariffs, particularly those imposed on the European Union. Why?
Yeah, so I didn't see that ranking, and I'm not actually sure why. North Carolina is the 12th most trade-dependent state. So we are more exposed than the average state. It is also true that some places have announced retaliation that seems like it will hurt North Carolina. Places are going up against our agricultural commodities, and North Carolina does export some of our agricultural commodities, particularly chickens, pork, turkey, some sweet potatoes, and a lot of tobacco. If China does not buy American tobacco, there is no other buyer in the world big enough to make that up.
As we've watched Donald Trump unleash Elon Musk and his Doge team on various agencies in the federal government, cutting people, cutting programs, ending funding for all kinds of things, and doing it with a machete rather than with surgical precision, Danielle, it appears that this could be the same approach going on with these tariffs, because there doesn't seem to be any surgical rhyme or reason. He just laid 10% on everybody and then used some sort of a calculation to decide what the tariff ought to be on other countries. And some economists have taken that calculation and torn it to shreds. Yeah. Is there something behind this that makes sense to legitimate economists and people who run the Fed or who run the Treasury Department?
Not to any mainstream economists I am aware of or that I have talked to. I say mainstream because President Trump has economic advisors like top economic advisor Kevin Hassett, top trade advisor Peter Navarro. They're the ones who will say, yeah, this is a great way of doing things. But no, mainstream economists totally believe that formula Trump and his team used just was a... I'm struggling to find a word I can say on the radio that economists have told me. Any economist I've talked to has hated it. And that formula is very heavily based around the U.S. trade deficit with any country. And again, as we have said earlier, Donald Trump seems to think that any sort of bilateral trade deficit means the U.S. is losing, that if the U.S. imports more than it exports from any given country, that that's somehow bad.
But Mark, isn't we go to the grocery store and we give our cash over for a bunch of bananas or a steak from the meat counter or a box of cereal from the grocery aisle? It's an exchange. The United States, a manufacturer, goes to some country and gets widgets and brings them back and exchanges dollars for those widgets and makes those widgets into whatever product they build. What's the difference in that exchange? Does it matter that we buy a lot of stuff from France or Germany or England and they don't buy as much from us?
It doesn't matter as much as it would seem from an overall sense. The United States economy, if you go back to the financial crisis, we were roughly the size of the EU. Today, we're about twice the size of the EU. So we've run a trade deficit all throughout that time period. And so certainly it hasn't hurt us in that respect, but there are communities that have been hurt, that have been manufacturing intensive communities, and there've got to be better ways of addressing.
Is that the fault of these trade deficits or other countries being mean to us, to use the parlance that Mr. Trump would use, or is it because of our own policies?
Well, the reason we have a large trade deficit is we have a large budget deficit, and we, as a nation, do not save enough to fund our investment. And so we have to import savings from overseas. In order for them to get dollars, we have to buy more stuff from them than they sell to us. So if we got rid of the budget deficit, that would help get rid of the trade deficit. But there are unfair trade practices out there. And I disagree with the method, but there are a lot of countries trade with us unfairly. And the odd thing about that formula, which I agree is incredibly arbitrary, but when it comes to the EU, it is probably closer to being right than the WTO stated tariffs, which say that there's only a 2.5% tariff on our exports to Europe, whereas that crazy formula came up with 20%. It's probably closer when you look at the non-tariff barriers. It's probably somewhere between 10 and 20%. Other countries made absolutely no sense.
So, Daniel, go ahead.
I would add one thing to what Mark is saying there, which is you can find all sorts of reasonable people, including on the left side of the aisle, who say that there are unfair trading practices in various parts of the world, especially China. That is very much true. I mean, back in, I think it was 2019, when he was running for the Democratic nomination, Bernie Sanders said he would use at least the threat of tariffs to try to remedy some of that. So this is not necessarily a right versus left thing. It is very much the method that Mark is talking about there, that Trump and his team said ahead of this that they were going to go in and really thoughtfully think about how to tailor these tariffs to each country, which, first of all, doing it globally is an absolutely huge kind of bananas idea. But besides that, you could theoretically try to do a trade deal with, say, China, with the EU, with Canada. You could say, hey, Canada, we don't like your protectionism around your dairy industry. Let's try to work something out. That takes a while. That takes a lot of closed door negotiations, and it's surgical. And that is not what Donald Trump does. He just took a sledgehammer to all of this.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think the interesting point here is that if another country is practicing unfair trade towards the U.S., that essentially the only way to try and address that, other than negotiation with sort of no threat, is you have to be willing to hurt your own economy to do it. There is no way to punish the other country that doesn't punish yourself. So if we punish China with tariffs, that makes everything more expensive for American consumers. And in general, American politicians don't want to punish Americans to accomplish some policy goal.
Well, politically,
the difference we have now is we have a president who's willing to do that.
But he ran for 3 years on the price of everything in the grocery store. And he was promised to bring it all down on day one. Of course, that has not happened. And in fact, prices have gone up and will now go up even more because of these tariffs. Politically, that, I'm sorry, it just seems insane to me.
Well, politically, President Trump doesn't have to run for election ever again. He's a lame duck. So he
yes, but,
doesn't
but
have
Danielle,
to care.
The Senate and the House do have to run again. One presumes, if we're going to have elections again, that they're going to have to run again. So this does matter to them, doesn't it?
It does, but I fully agree with you. And also, those Republicans in the House and Senate have found over and over and over in recent years that if you run counter to anything Donald Trump likes, that you are going to be punished, that you are
but
going
isn't
to have-
that be- but isn't that because he's captured the party and he's captured the party's base? But if the party's base elected him to lower the price of eggs and he's going to raise the price of eggs and everything else, aren't they going to turn their backs on him and therefore be more helpful to opposition in the House and Senate?
That is possible. You're absolutely right. That could happen. The question is, how much pain does it take? Because the one thing I would add to counter what you're saying there is, when you say he ran on the price of eggs and now the price of eggs are going up, you're assuming that voters are voting strictly on policy and policy outcomes. That is, in my experience, not how voters think these days. Voters very much have these partisan identities where they can find a reason to vote for whoever they want to vote for. But if you are a dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore, MAGA-to-your-core fan, you really want to stick with Donald Trump, and it's going to take a lot to shake you away. Maybe even $12 eggs. It could take a while.
Well, Jeff, talk to me about that, because if you're willing to stick with him because you like him, because you like his approach to these things. You elected him to go in and break things, and that's exactly what he's doing, and that makes you happy. But suddenly you go to the grocery store, and everything is unaffordable. You go and try to buy a car, and now it's $10,000 or $15,000 more than it was last week. You go and buy an iPhone that you used to be able to pick up for $600, $700, and now it's $3,000. You go to replace your computer that used to be $800, and now it's $4,000. At some point, where is the pain level that people simply will not endure?
I think the pain level is, as we found out under President Biden, the pain level is when people find they can't afford to buy the stuff they were buying before. So Americans want to have a job and they want to be able to buy their stuff. We like
so
stuff.
So when will that begin to happen? I know that one of your areas of expertise is in agriculture, and you've been dealing with agriculture both here in North Carolina and in the state of Georgia, both for the state of Georgia and for a university there. And we all have to eat, and we all buy food almost every day of our lives. So when will we start to really feel that pain, and where will we feel that pain?
Sure. So you're going to start to feel the pain immediately the very next time you go to the grocery store. And where you will see it right now is in out-of-season fruits and vegetables. So it's going to be the produce department, where the blueberries are coming from Peru, probably, or Chile. And same with the grapes and some of the other things that are just starting to, right? We're just spring here, so things are just starting to grow. Those aren't our spring or summer vegetables in the store. They're from South America. So that's where the price is going to go up first. But groceries aren't a thing that's going to go up enough to break Trump's voter support, probably. It's going to be more big ticket items. And that takes more time because we don't buy cars very often. We don't buy houses very often. We don't buy computers very often. So just bit by bit, people will shop for those things and experience the sticker shock.
Mike, let me just say that about the iPhones. I mean, there have been all sorts of crazy numbers that have been thrown out there. But if you put the 84% tariff on an iPhone from China, the price of the iPhone doesn't go up 84%. The tariff is on the landed value. It's really the manufactured cost. And most of the price of an iPhone is intellectual property. It is the brand equity. It's the design. And so that 84% increase would cause the price of an iPhone imported from China to go up by about $240. And a 46% tariff on Vietnam, it would be about $138. Most forecasts for inflation, including the most dire expectations for tariffs, have somewhere between a half a percentage point and a full percentage point increase in inflation over what it would have been otherwise. And that's really for 2025. 2026, well, there's no impact on inflation.
How can higher prices be good for the economy, particularly since some economists are now saying we are already in a recession, an economy that was not projected to have any recession on the horizon at all? How can that be good?
Well, higher prices are not good. I'm not arguing that any of this is good. There just seems to be a little bit of hysteria. For a $50,000 car imported from Germany, the tariff impact of the impacts that the tariffs that we put on in Europe would raise the price by about $8,000. So it's not as dramatic. It's not that the tariffs are not assessed on the retail price, but it's certainly not good for the economy, particularly at a time where growth is slowing and we may be in recession.
Mark Fitner is chief economist at Piedmont Crescent Capital. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about tariffs and their impact on the economy with Mark Vitner, the chief economist at Piedmont Crescent Capital. Danielle Kurtzleben is White House correspondent for NPR, and Jeff Dorfman is a professor of agriculture and resource economics at NC State University. Jeff, you told ABC 11 in Raleigh that if tariffs on wine coming from the EU were to take effect, a $20 bottle of wine would go to $50, and a glass of wine in a restaurant could equal the price of the entree. That cannot be good for the customer, for the retailer, for the wine producer. So is this similar to the multiplier effect that economists, you guys talk about all the time, about how money multiplies as it winds its way through the economy? If it does it on the positive side, is there a negative side to this spread of higher prices to the economy?
Not exactly. So if the prices of some goods go up because of tariffs and nobody gets a raise, then we have to spend less on something. And so there's less demand for sort of everything, and some prices may go down. So it's not going to create a spiral, but there certainly will be lots of displacement. So the things where the tariffs hit the hardest are the items we will buy the most less of, if you will. And then we'll have to shift everything around, and it'll be like a mini version of the broken supply chains during COVID, where everything gets confused, people try and ship in new ways, and it doesn't work perfectly all the time.
So, Daniel, nobody wants to see higher prices, and certainly nobody wants to see a decline in their investment portfolio, particularly their 401ks, but that is already happening. And yesterday, as you referenced on Capitol Hill, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer insisted that the tariff policies of the Trump administration were focused on Main Street, and he dismissed concerns about how American retirement accounts are affected by the steep drop in the market. He said, quote, "We're not going to be in a situation where we keep allowing Wall Street to run the economy." But 401ks are directly connected to Main Street. Is the administration tone deaf to that? I mean, that sounds like political suicide to me.
I mean, they're certainly putting the best face on this policy that they possibly can, I think is one way to put it. And they are sticking to their guns that these policies are going to benefit particularly blue-collar Americans, people who work in manufacturing or who are adjacent to manufacturing. And you have while the response to these tariffs has overwhelmingly been negative, absolutely, the bits of positivity you've seen have been from the manufacturing industry. Even Sean Fain of the United Auto Workers, who notably detested Trump during the election last year, came out and said, look, still dislike most of what he stands for, but I like these tariffs. And
but is he kidding? He likes those tariffs because he thinks he's bringing automobile manufacturing back to the United States. Right. Is that a realistic goal? And if it is a realistic goal, when would we actually see automobile manufacturing up and running at a greater degree in the United States? And would those cars be being made by human beings or by robots? And would it make any difference?
Oh, that listen, my short answer is I don't know. We don't know, right? Because we have there are so many conflicting factors there, because first of all, you have higher costs for inputs. You know, those tariffs that Donald Trump put on steel and aluminum, that makes making cars more expensive. Yes, maybe you have a little bit less foreign competition that benefits the U.S. manufacturers. But then also, you're right, there is more technology and more robots to make those cars than there were back in the 70s and 80s, the heyday that now Donald Trump likes to tell people about. The one other thing I would add to all of this is that when he is talking about short-term pain for long-term gain, let's say hypothetically that this really does mean more production for U.S. auto manufacturers. Let's say that manufacturers really do see the need to crank out more American cars. They can add shifts right now. They can maybe add some workers. But the amount of time it takes to build a new factory, if that's what Donald Trump really wants, that takes years, or it can take years. And so the run-up to that could take such a long time.
And Mark, it takes not only years to build the factory, it takes a leap of faith for the companies that have to invest the billions of dollars it would cost to build these factories in the United States. And if you upend the world trade order and the world economy in a country that changes the president every 4 years, and with it, like we change our socks, we're going to change our policy, how can you afford to commit to that?
Yeah, there's a couple of issues here. First off, the amount of capacity that we're using in the auto industry. So without having to add any equipment or build any factories, we're only using 64% of capacity today. The norm is around 73%. So we could increase output in current factories. The same is true in the steel industry. So there is an abundance of capacity. We have the most efficient steel producer in the world in Nucor, headquartered in Charlotte, and located all over. It's also the largest or second largest producer in the United States now. And so we have the ability to boost output. In terms of reshoring, one of the things that's frustrating to me is that in the latter part of the 1990s, we were seeing significant reshoring, mainly because of the uncertainty in global shipping and all of the interruptions that we had seen to supply chains, and the fact that the labor cost of producing just about everything was becoming a smaller proportion of a product's price. We were seeing the latter part of the 90s had the strongest growth in manufacturing since manufacturing peaked in employment peaked in 1979. So we were on the path to that. I'm afraid this is going to throw us off track. I think
talk to me about how tariffs work, Jeff. I mean, all during the campaign, Donald Trump talked about the big, beautiful tariffs and how it was going to fix everything that's wrong with America and free us from these unfair trade practices that we've endured for years and years and years. Like when he said that he would build a wall and that Mexico would pay for it, which they did not, he also kept insisting that other countries pay the tariffs. But in fact, we pay for the tariffs, do we not? I mean, if prices are going up, we're paying for them.
So everybody pays for the tariffs. So if we stick a tariff on imported goods from China, the Chinese producer is likely to offer us a somewhat lower price. So they pay part of the tariff. The American company importing the product ends up earning a lower profit because they're having to try and sell this at a higher price. So they end up eating some of the tariff. And then the consumer ends up paying some of the tariff at higher prices. So actually everybody along the road from when the product is made through all the middlemen, the retailer, till the consumer, everybody pays a tiny little bit. It's what we call tax incidence. We don't know exactly what share everybody pays, and it varies by good. But a good estimate that I've seen is the foreign country pays about a third, the American companies producing, importing pay about a third, and the American consumer pays about a third. Again, that's going to vary for every good, but at a rough start, you could think of it that way.
Hmm. Danielle, it has been said of Mr. Trump that for him, a win is when he wins and you lose. It's a zero-sum game for him. Right. And that everything is transactional and he has to be the winner. Which leads me to a question that I've heard bandied about by other people, and I don't know whether it holds any water or not, but could there be an alternative motive to what's going on here with these tariffs? And I ask because there are those who believe that the uber wealthy, including Trump, will profit, not just from the rising price of goods because they're manufacturing them, but because of these declines in the stock market, because they knew this was coming and they swooped in and they short sold. Any evidence of that?
Not to my knowledge, no. And I think that I have seen these kinds of theories thrown around on Twitter, Blue Sky, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. I think that the fact that these kind of theories are flying around, to me, let me leave aside whether there's any proof for any of them, because to my knowledge, there's not. They're just a measure to me of how baffled everyone is by these tariffs. These tariffs are so hard to explain by pretty much any mainstream thinker that people are reaching for some sort of a way to explain why on earth would you do this?
Was there a reason to do this? That's the big question, I think, because the economy was going very well. Not everybody was benefiting equally from it. Part of that is due to our policy mistakes over time, et cetera, and neglect in certain areas. But was there a reason to do this? If there were some problems that needed to be fixed, were there other ways to fix them, Daniel?
Sure, absolutely. Once again, I mean, you have seen presidents for decades try to do something about the hollowing out of manufacturing and the fact that America has gone from a goods-based to a service-based economy. Not everybody thinks that's bad, but it definitely hurts some people and hurts some people a lot. And so you have seen, you saw President Obama talk about, you know, advanced manufacturing. He tried to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership as one way to deal with China and its economic the economically unfair practices that they have. You've seen other presidents, other leaders try to do something about all sorts of things. And again, like I said earlier, you can find a lot of people, very reasonable people, who say, Yeah, China is acting unfairly. We needed to do something to curb that. But it is very hard to find an economist, at least as far as I know, who will say this was the way to do it. It certainly does not appear it that way.
Mark, Trump is also against globalism, and he wants everything to be centered here in this country. He wants us to be the manufacturing powerhouse that perhaps he saw us as being in the mid-20th century. But we are already a manufacturing powerhouse. And I'm wondering if most Americans want to bring back manufacturing to the degree he'd like to see it, because A, as we've already discussed, those jobs don't pay that much as they used to in comparison to other jobs. B, a lot of those manufacturing jobs will be taken by robots. And C, they're going to end up with producing more expensive goods. We like our TVs to be cheap. We like to go online and buy a sweater or a T-shirt from Temu for $10 that we would have spent $80 in a store for. That's going to be the result of this, isn't it?
Yeah, in terms of the timing, I think that the reason the president wanted to do this now is he wanted to do it in the early part of his presidency and have better news as we get closer to elections. And in terms of what he wants to accomplish in terms of reshoring, you know, I don't think he really, in his heart of hearts, would think that we're going to get back to the 1950s and the post-war kind of peak of manufacturing in the United States. That's not likely to happen. But the idea that manufacturing jobs are low-paying jobs, I don't think is correct. I mean, there's a big difference between pay in urban areas and pay in rural areas. And in many rural areas, those manufacturing jobs are the highest-paying jobs in those rural areas. There are also jobs that take a much less training than going to college. And if you subtract the cost of going to college and you put that into the equation of how much you're earning, folks that are working in manufacturing are doing pretty well. So the issue that I have surrounding the return of manufacturing is if you drive from Gastonia to Boone, like I do quite often, you see help wanted advertising signs for every manufacturer along that route. And it's been that way for years. It's very hard for manufacturers to find the workers as it is. There's about 400,000 job openings in manufacturing today. So I question, you know, what we're going to accomplish by suddenly reshoring a lot of manufacturing jobs.
And Jeff, even if the president doesn't really believe that we can return to the manufacturing heyday of the the 1950s, for instance, isn't that the whole premise behind the economic premise behind Make America Great Again, to take us back to that time? But we have to remember that time. We were coming out of World War II. We were the only power left standing. We kind of rebuilt the entire Western world with our economy and our efforts around the globe. We can't repeat that. This is a global and intertwined economy now, isn't it? And we can't extricate ourselves from that. Aren't we cutting off our nose despite our face, Jeffrey?
Definitely we are. If we reverse globalization, then we will be poorer. I mean, that is the result. If we have more international trade, we all end up richer. And Mark is right that some people are hurt by that. But in aggregate, overall, we're much better off being more connected to the rest of the world.
So if we're going to go through pain, and apparently we are, unless he reverses course in the next couple of weeks, when will the pain pay off? And what will the payoff look like? And will it be better than what we've been living through? I'm not sure who to ask that question. Jeff, go ahead.
I would think the payoff would be more jobs in the U.S. and more output. And because of the amount of time it takes to build new factories and to set up new supply chains, that payoff is likely to be 3 to 5 years down the road.
Mark, are we willing as consumers and as American citizens to wait that long?
I'm not sure. I mean, the issue that I care the most about is the sourcing of pharmaceuticals from overseas, because right now, many of the pharmaceuticals that we source from China are laced with carcinogens, and it's a very close call as to whether it's better to take the medicine or not. And we need to reshore that back to the United States. And that's something that has broad political support on both sides of the aisle. So I'm hoping that we get there. But in terms of Trump, a lot of businesses don't want to do business with Trump because of all the drama that goes along with it. And I'm afraid that's what the rest of the world's going to be, how they're going to view us.
I have about 10,000 more questions, but we are out of time. Mark Bittner, chief economist with Piedmont Crescent Capital, Daniel Kurtzleben, White House correspondent for NPR, and Jeff Dorfman, professor of agriculture and resource economics at NC State University. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.